Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John C. Filo, legal director with the Sugar Law Center, who examines the recent court ruling in Detroit's bankruptcy case and the impact it may have on public employee pensions in the Motor City and other municipalities across the country. Save the Tigris campaign coordinator, Johanna Rivera, who discusses the problem of water shortages in southern Iraq related to the building of dams along both the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And investigative journalist Robert Perry, who recounts the shameful chapter in American history where President Ronald Reagan embraced South Africa's apartheid regime and branded Nelson Mandela a communist and terrorist. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Lawyers for long-term detainees at the U.S. military prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have appealed to the European Court of Human Rights to expose torture at a former secret CIA prison in Poland. The two detainees pressing the case are Saudi national Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, who currently faces murder charges from the 2000 bombing of the USS Cole in Yemen, and alleged al-Qaeda militant Abu Zubaydah. A 2009 declassified report says the CIA viewed Nashiri and Zubaydah as high-value detainees who were covertly imprisoned at Guantanamo. Both men were transferred to Poland in December 2002 and subjected to harsh interrogations. According to the Associated Press, the two detainees endured mock executions, waterboarding, and were falsely told their families had been arrested and sexually abused. Polish prosecutor Janusz Sliwa urged the European court to delay the case so his government could conclude its own investigation, which has already been underway for over 5 years. Human rights groups believe 8 high-value detainees had been sent to a Polish military facility, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the so-called mastermind of the 9/11 terror attacks. In the aftermath of the 2012 murder of Trayvon Martin in Florida, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, has lost major funders like Amazon, Coca-Cola, General Electric, and Walmart. ALEC lost support in response to the group's controversial advocacy of Stand Your Ground gun legislation, which was adopted by Florida and 26 other states. George Zimmerman, who shot Martin, had used the Florida law to successfully argue he acted in self-defense. Since the Trayvon Martin shooting, ALEC's membership of conservative state legislators has shrunk. And while the billionaire Koch brothers and other right-wing foundations remain key funders, the group has reportedly lost a total of 60 corporate donors and is running a budget deficit. To regain critical corporate support, ALEC has devised a scheme called the Prodigal Son Project, where most of ALEC's activities would be transferred to a 501c4 social welfare group named the Jefferson Project that would be permitted to engage in lobbying and hide the identity of its donors. The emergence of the new digital currency known as Bitcoin has excited tech-savvy investors while alarming law enforcement agencies. Now, the U.S. Federal Election Commission is investigating whether or not Bitcoins can be used to make political campaign contributions. Libertarian candidates are already accepting Bitcoins on their websites, and conservative groups are looking to the FEC for approval to accept Bitcoin donations. In recent months, the exchange value of Bitcoins have skyrocketed, driven by speculators, including many investors in China, who are looking for ways to evade capital controls and send large amounts of money overseas. Bitcoin, which is not backed by any central bank, has been used in the buying and selling of illegal drugs and money laundering. While Bitcoin's transactions can be seen in an online ledger, the new currency is not tied to an individual's identity like a check or a credit card, a fact which troubles advocates for campaign finance reform. Adam Smith, a spokesperson for Public Campaign, told the Los Angeles Times, "There are some questions about transparency with these donations. We need to make sure those are addressed so that Bitcoin donors can't hide behind donations to remain anonymous." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Detroit, an American city that once was the hub of the world's leading automobile manufacturers, became the largest municipality in U.S. history to enter into Chapter 9 bankruptcy after federal judge Stephen Rhodes handed down his ruling on December 3rd in a controversial case being watched closely around the country. The ruling allows bankruptcy proceedings to move forward over the objections of 48 labor union groups and public employee retirees who had urged Judge Rhodes to reject Detroit's eligibility for bankruptcy. Opponents of the ruling have already taken steps to appeal the case. As part of the bankruptcy process, Judge Rhodes announced he will allow Detroit, which is $18 billion in debt, to cut pension benefits, but emphasized that he will only authorize pension cuts if he finds them to be fair and equitable. Because Judge Rhodes' authorization for cuts to city workers' pensions is viewed as a possible landmark legal precedent for other cities in financial trouble, retirees and labor unions were quite naturally alarmed. Further, Detroit's unelected emergency manager, Kevin Orr, who was appointed by Michigan's anti-union Republican Governor Rick Snyder, has moved forward on privatization of city services and signaled he may sell off many masterpieces in the city's Institute of Arts Museum. Your reporter spoke with John C. Filo, legal director with the Maurice and Jane Sugar Law Center for Economic and Social Justice. Here he examines the recent court ruling in Detroit's bankruptcy case and the impact it may have on public employee pensions in the Motor City and other municipalities across the country.
One of the main issues from our perspective and other perspectives is, A, whether the city, through this emergency manager that the state has now appointed as a new form of government here in Michigan, actually negotiated in good faith with its creditors, and particularly the unions. And then the second largest issue, I think, was whether or not the city or the emergency manager acting as the city can cut pension benefits and retiree health care plans to the degree or to any degree or to the degree that he's contemplating. We have a constitutional provision here in Michigan that attempts to protect pension rights. That's in the state constitution. So a real question for the judge was, does that constitutional provision make it such that the emergency manager can't touch those sort of pension rights in the bankruptcy? Ultimately, Rhodes decided that they can go after these pensions, although the judge did caution that he has to approve any plan, and the decision should not be read as him lightly granting that sort of approval in advance.
How do you think Judge Rhodes' ruling here could set a dangerous precedent, jeopardizing the security of public employee pensions in cities across the U.S.?
Well, these become the targets. These become the way to balance your budget. I think that's a tremendous threat. Here in Detroit, the average non-uniformed pensioner is about $16,000 a year, and they also get health care benefits because they're not entitled to Medicare. The uniformed employees, it's about 30,000. These people are not living large. They don't have, predominantly do not have large pensions. It is a pensions that basically get these people through to be able to live with some modicum of dignity. The proposals that have been put forward are cutting the health care by about 80%, and same with some of these pensions. To take someone who's making $16,000 a year and cut the senior's health care by 80% when they're not covered by Medicare or other programs, that's immoral, and it should, I don't know, words escape me, the level of outrage that people should have on that. And that, what's happening in Detroit, is likely to set a precedent for other cities, other municipalities. It's profoundly unique and profoundly dangerous to adopt that as your plan for going forward. Detroit is the first city to hit this level of crisis where the state is literally contributing nothing to stabilizing the community, to stabilizing the public services, or to shoring up pensions. Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, New York, Cleveland, and a host of other cities have saw grave financial crises at various times during the past 30 years. In each of those instances, the state came in, and eventually, in some cases, the federal government came in to help stabilize the situation so you could move forward from there. Well, Michigan state government has a principle that they will not contribute and will not provide monetary support in any way. Now, that's when the state actually was running a budget surplus the past couple of years. And the way they've done that is cutting revenue sharing to cities, which was part of the process that led to Detroit hitting a crisis. I think that's, you know, that's another precedent that's being set here, and that should cause folks some grave concern. For the state government to sort of morally abdicate its role is, to me, unconscionable. When Detroit's troubles are not because of local corruption and not because of local incompetence, we have, like every large city in the country, our fair share of corruption and incompetence. But this financial crisis is directly traceable to policies of deindustrialization that this country bought into, this country put in place for the past 20 to 30 years. Those were policy choices we made consciously, and it hit Detroit, an industrialized city, very hard, coupled with predatory lending and some of the highest foreclosure rates in the country, which has a direct impact on property tax revenues here in the city, and then unemployment. What we have in the city is a concentration of some of the of a very large low-income population who don't have the resources to weather those sort of storms. And we've said to those people, you're on your own. But why do we do it? And I don't think you can get around the fact of what this city looks like. And it's two factors. One, it's predominantly African American. And two, it's seen as a union city. And if those two variables weren't in play, I have a, you know, it's just my opinion, but a very strong feeling that the country would have a very different reaction, particularly when I say the country. I think most people in the country are highly empathetic with Detroit, but from those people who are in positions of institutional power within the government and elsewhere might have a very different reaction.
That was John C. Filo, legal director with the Maurice and Jane Sugar Law Center for Economic and Social Justice. Find links to analysis and commentary on Detroit's bankruptcy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Johanna Rivera is a former pharmacy graduate student. In 2010, she decided to postpone her PhD dissertation and travel to Israel-Palestine, where she worked for the Tent of Nations, the Palestine Solidarity Project, and the Cayenne Feminist Organization. Rivera then moved to the Kurdistan region of Iraq, where she worked on human rights issues ranging from violence against women, honor killings, internally displaced camps, and most recently she's been working across Iraq and internationally in an advocacy campaign to protect the Tigris River from dams upstream in Turkey and Iran. Rivera, now coordinator of Iraq's Save the Tigris campaign, has traveled to Tunisia, Turkey, and Jordan to talk about the need to protect water rights and the social, cultural, and environmental heritage of Mesopotamia. She recently spoke at the New Haven, Connecticut Public Library in a program titled Iraq, 10 Years After Shock and Awe, sponsored by the Middle East Crisis Committee. In this excerpt of Rivera's December 4th talk, she addresses the problem of water shortages, especially for the people of the marshes in southern Iraq. Former dictator Saddam Hussein drained the marshes in the early 1990s to force the Shia marsh dwellers to leave their land, but they are now returning to their former home under the current Shia-led government. However, they are still threatened by dam projects initiated by Turkey along both the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, where there are more than 22 dams so far, and more planned.
Iraq is fed from the Euphrates and the Tigris. Already there have been 9 dams already built, mostly on the Euphrates, and the flow on the Euphrates has decreased, they say, up to 80%. And this, of course, affects agriculture and affects the marshes, which were in a process of restoration. The marshes are also proposed as a World Heritage Site, but this is based on that there is enough water to keep them alive. And the thing, the marshes are a unique ecosystem, both culturally and naturally. It hosts a lot of biodiversity and endangered species that only live in that area. And think about the repercussions of not having water in Iraq. More conflicts for water. They were talking about Syria being speed up this civil war because of resources and because of water. There was a big drought 2007 to 2009. People migrated to the big cities. There was not enough accommodation. There were not enough jobs. So the same will happen in Iraq. This area of the marshes is said to be the place of the Garden of Eden. So it has a lot of historical and cultural value for the people. The people that live there, they depend totally on the ecosystem. They depend on water. They build from reed their houses. They feed their animals, the water buffaloes, from the reed. 500,000 people were displaced during the Iran-Iraq war and after the drainage of the marshes. Some of them have come back, but if they're going to have water issues, and now we have seen that some of the farmers and some of the fishermen have been migrating up where there is more water. So it's already causing a resource struggle. So what we have been doing in the campaign is that because this dam is being built in Turkey, we have contacted the people in Turkey, the Turkish activists, the people that have been fighting against the dam, because it's also in Turkey is going to flood a potential World Heritage Site. So we have been in contact with them and tried to build a coalition to raise awareness of the dangers in Turkey, but also in Iraq, because the Iraqi government has been very silent about this issue. There have been negotiations, but Turkey, it's the upstream state, so they have the upper hand. They can decide what to do because the waters are born in their territory. So for them, they consider that as long as the water is in their territory, they can develop the river as they want. International law, which is something that we have been working with, and conventions, international conventions, says that if there is a transboundary river, you need a transboundary impact assessment, to see what are the impacts downstream. That hasn't happened yet. Turkey hasn't had an evaluation of what will be the impacts in Iraq. So we've been trying to raise awareness from Iraq, from the Iraqi citizens, so they can demand their government that they work on this issue. So it's also an issue of governance, weak governance in Iraq, corruption, a lack of institutions that are strong enough. The Ministry of Environment, you have the Ministry of Water Resources, and they say it's the other ministry. The other ministry say it's the parliament. The Kurds say that it's the Arabs. It's Baghdad who has to deal with it. So it's international repercussions, it's national repercussions, and it's then provincial, like between provinces, how they will divide the water. So we have been doing a lot of work inside Iraq in different provinces, especially in the south, Basra, Misan, Amara, Nasriya, where the marshes are. We also were in Tunis, trying to connect with movements in the international level. We had a session with people from India. They had a lot of experience with the big dam, the Narmada project in the 90s. So we heard from them. We had people from Peru, from Mexico. We had our colleagues from Turkey. I was speaking about Iraq. So it was very good, to exchange ideas and how people have fought this issue in other countries.
That was Johanna Rivera, Save the Tigris campaign coordinator. Her talk in New Haven was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find more information on water issues in Iraq and Rivera's advocacy work by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the world mourned the passing of Nelson Mandela, the much-loved father of post-apartheid South Africa, 100 current or former heads of state joined tens of thousands of his country's citizens at a national memorial service held in his honor at Soweto's FNB Soccer Stadium. Since he died on December 5th, the legacy of the 95-year-old symbol of South Africa's struggle for equality and justice has been the subject of much media coverage in the U.S. and around the globe. While President Obama, whose speech in Soweto was greeted with cheers, lauded Mandela as a giant of history and the last great liberator of the 20th century, United States policy toward South Africa and its official view of Mandela weren't always so reverential. While millions of people across the U.S. and the world mobilized to condemn South Africa's brutal apartheid government and demanded the imposition of economic sanctions in the 1980s, America's President Ronald Reagan opposed those measures and branded Nelson Mandela as a communist and terrorist. Steeped in Cold War ideology, Reagan pursued a strategy known at the time as constructive engagement, where his administration offered support to the apartheid regime by inviting senior South African security officials to Washington, violated a UN arms embargo, and vetoed a UN Security Council resolution that would have imposed worldwide economic sanctions on Pretoria. The Reagan administration also placed Nelson Mandela on a U.S. list of international terrorists, where he remained until 2008. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist Robert Perry, founder and editor of ConsortiumNews.com and author. Here, Perry discusses the life of Nelson Mandela, a lawyer, freedom fighter, 27-year in prison activist, and the first democratically elected president of South Africa, and the shameful chapter in American foreign policy, where Ronald Reagan clearly placed the U.S. on the wrong side of history.
Cold Warriors tended to be fairly sympathetic to the apartheid regime, the white regime. You did see some differences. Under President Carter, there was some moves to respect human rights, more and more pressure being placed on the apartheid regime. But then President Reagan came in 1981 and argued that there should not be any kind of embargoes or any that kind of overt pressure on South Africa. There should be what he called constructive engagement, that is sort of quiet diplomacy, trying to get some reforms in South Africa, but essentially a go-slow approach to dealing with the blacks who were demanding their rights in a democracy. So that's the picture where my story sort of picks up, with this battle that goes on in the 1980s between a growing movement to isolate the South African apartheid regime, to engage in economic punishments for its behavior, to disinvest in the country, to make it a cultural pariah. Reagan opposed that, and even when the Congress, with Republicans, many Republicans on board as well, voted to enact sanctions against South Africa in 1986, Reagan vetoed that bill, and it was passed over his veto, with many Republicans breaking with him. Reagan kept insisting that this had to be seen essentially through a Cold War prism, while saying he opposed apartheid, was not willing to take any strong action to end it, to force the South African government to make radical changes.
As I read history, it seems that Ronald Reagan and British Prime Minister at the time, Margaret Thatcher, branded Mandela and the ANC, the African National Congress, as a terrorist/communist organization. Expand on that a bit, if you would, in terms of the worldview that interpreted people fighting for their freedom under a very, I think, what could only be considered a fascistic regime in South Africa as somehow an illegitimate use of any means necessary to gain rights for some 80% of that population that were denied their rights.
Well, Reagan and Thatcher were basically on the side of the white supremacist government in South Africa. I'm not sure there's any other way to say it. They took their side, and Reagan saw the South African regime as an important ally in seeking to overthrow other governments in Africa that he considered too leftist. For instance, in Angola, he was supporting a group called UNITA, headed by a sociopath named Jonas Savimbi, who took to burning his opponents at the stake. So Reagan was relying on the South African regime to help out in terms of providing supply lines and military training and support for some of these, what Reagan would consider liberation movements, fighting against socialist governments. This was part of this international anti-communist movement that Reagan saw himself leading, and Thatcher too, that involved the brutal both counterinsurgency and insurgency operations in Central America. That's mostly what I covered at the time.
In this period where the nation and the world is mourning the passing of Nelson Mandela, there's a tendency to sanitize or Disney-fy his legacy and his struggles and his beliefs. Could you talk a bit about what many Americans, during a lot of media attention on the life of Nelson Mandela, may not understand about the man and what he believed in?
Well, he was a dedicated revolutionary in the situation that he found himself in. It always strikes me as odd that Americans sometimes recoil at that, even though we come from a nation built on a revolution. I would argue a revolution much less justified than what some of the people of the blacks of South Africa encountered in terms of the degradation of their liberties versus what was happening in the English colonies in the United, now the United States. But Mandela certainly was a person who felt that at different points in his life that an armed revolution was going to be necessary to get rid of this oppressive white rule in South Africa. After his imprisonment, he evolved into a person who believed more in the power of nonviolent resistance, which is not for the faint of heart either. So I think what you see is a complex person who achieved a great deal. Certainly he proved Ronald Reagan wrong. Ronald Reagan's predictions and fear-mongering about the ANC being this terrorist communist entity led by this wild man Mandela turned out not to be correct. And the ANC, despite its many flaws, and Mandela himself, accepted a kind of neoliberal capitalism for the country, did not bring about the kind of major economic, social changes that some had hoped, but they certainly were not what Ronald Reagan thought they were. It has certainly not been the sort of aggressively revolutionary movement that Reagan claimed it would be.
That was investigative journalist Robert Perry, editor of ConsortiumNews.com and one of the reporters who helped expose the Iran-Contra scandal in the mid-1980s. He's the author of America's Stolen Narrative. Find links to Perry's recent article on Mandela and Reagan by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.